What was it like to hear about the JFK assassination? Or America's triumph over Hitler? We're seeing Queen at Live Aid. Our past is a collection of stories that bring us to now. Welcome to the Eyewitness History Podcast, where we view history through the eyes of the people that watch the events that shaped our world. Here's your host, Josh Cohen, and these are their stories.
Hello, everyone, and thank you for tuning into this episode of Eyewitness History. I am your host, Josh Cohen. This episode, I speak with Chris Tarbell, a former FBI special agent. Chris Tarbell specializes in cyber investigations and incident response. As a case agent with the FBI's preeminent cybercrime squad in New York, he led some of the most groundbreaking cybercrime investigations in the world, including the arrest and prosecutions of Anonymous and LulzSec leadership, and the founder of the notorious Silk Road Underground Marketplace, the latter of which resulted in the largest seizure of bitcoins to date. As a computer forensic examiner with the FBI, Chris engaged in rapid response investigations all over the world on matters related to terrorism, botnets, and other cybercrimes. In 2009, Chris joined the FBI's renowned cybercrime squad as a special agent in the New York field office. He was the lead investigator on several of the Bureau's most complex and cutting-edge cases, including the takedown of the billion-dollar cryptocurrency-based drug marketplace Silk Road, and the arrest of its founder, as well as the investigation and arrest of the leadership of the Anonymous LulzSec hacking crews. I had him on for a little under an hour, and I really enjoyed it. We discuss a lot. We certainly discuss his involvement in both the Anonymous and LulzSec leadership. We discuss what it's like being an FBI special agent, why he got out of it, what he's doing now, and we also discuss his recent appearance on the mega-popular podcast Lex Fridman. And now I give you Chris Tarbell. Okay, I'm here with Chris Tarbell. Chris, thanks for coming on the podcast.
Oh, thanks for inviting me. I'm excited.
Yeah, I'm excited too. It's my pleasure. I'm really excited to speak with you. I want to discuss your career as an FBI agent, your involvement with Silk Road, your work against Anonymous, and definitely a lot more. But before we do, please tell our listeners that might not be familiar with you who you are and what you do.
Sure. So I'm Chris Tarbell. I was an FBI agent. I was in the Bureau for nearly 10 years. I traveled the world doing computer forensics for the first four, and then the last six, I was an agent in New York City. Some of the bigger cases I worked on was the Anonymous case, where I arrested Sabu. He was a big hacker in the day. And then I flipped him and convinced him to work with the FBI. So that was, you know, a lot of insight and a lot of education on what's going on in the hacking world. And then I led a couple other arrests in between Sabu, and then I got to a big case called Silk Road that I'm sure we'll get into the details. They started making books and movies about it, so it was a very exciting case. And I was the case agent on that case, and arrested Ross Ulbricht. He was the leader of the Silk Road. And then since then, I left the government. I was lured out. That's a fun story to tell if we want to talk about it. Yeah. And now I am a founding member at Naxo. It's a cybersecurity company here in New York City. And I'm a podcast host, too. I do a podcast called Hacker in the Fed. So that's where my world is now.
Awesome. Awesome. Thank you, Chris. So winding the clock back a little bit then, where did your interest in the FBI and cybersecurity start? What drew you to it?
So I went to college. I went to James Madison University, and I went there to be a doctor. I wanted to become a doctor. But then about my junior year, I decided that's not really what I wanted to do. And I got tied into the Campus Cadet Program. It was a student-run organization that we started in. We were in the basement of the James Madison University Police Department, and they gave us keys and a flashlight and a police radio, and we were out giving safety escorts to people and locking up academic buildings were our two things. So if people were too scared to walk home or didn't want to walk on campus by themselves, they called us and we'd walk them from wherever they were going to wherever they were coming. But we were also an extra set of eyes on campus. And so we, were with the police radio, we call things in. And that was very exciting to me. You know, I grew up in Virginia Beach and I grew up next to the chief of police. And so I always was excited by law enforcement, but there was no one in my family behind it. So, but when I was a campus cadet, I met a guy named Sid Hartman. He was a sergeant at the JMU Police Department. And Sid, we sat in his car one day and he's like, cybercrime is the wave of the future. If you want to be a cop, get into cyber. And he was doing forensics at the time and those sort of cases. And, you know, I took the word of advice. I walked up the next day to the science department and asked what I could do to get a double major. And the head of the computer science department said, stay and get a master's degree. So finish out the pre-med and get a master's degree in computer science and do it that way. And so what got me interested was Sid Hartman.
That's awesome. No, thanks, Chris. I love to know, careful how I phrase this, how would you describe the personality profile of an ideal FBI agent? Does that question make sense?
It does. The answer is not easy because there isn't one. You know, so in New York, we have a lot of finite squads. Like my squad was CY2, and we did cyber criminal intrusions, which meant there was national security cyber intrusions. And, you know, there was a squad for, you know, left-handed bank robbers. I kid, there wasn't really. but that's how specialized and how big the New York FBI was. And so you kind of got into your, you know, into a hole on what you wanted to be. And my classmates, you know, we all went to the FBI Academy together and had that shared experience. And then we all went to different offices and became totally different careers. Whereas the FBI, you kind of get lost in the shuffle to begin with. But, you know, I'm a month in the squad and I'm working on a terrorism case, a guy who wanted to blow up the New York City subway. Where my classmate, he got to his office and he was on the SWAT team the first day just because he was the young guy. The older guys didn't want to do SWAT. So vastly different experiences. But if I was to build my ultimate FBI squad, it would be with totally different personalities. I want qualities from different people from all the different. I don't want everything. I don't want a robot. I don't want just FBI agents to not have, you know, different personalities. I want to have all different aspects and different skill sets. And, you know, then I've taken that philosophy on to Naxo now. So we have the same thing. We have a really smart guy. That's one thing I'm very good at is finding very smart guys. We have a good business guy. We got a guy who's got tons and tons of experience. So I just don't think there's an ideal FBI personality.
Yeah, that makes sense to me. Interesting. So, you know what? Do you mind? Can you talk at all about that first case with the New York City subway?
Sure.
Yeah. Would you mind?
Oh, I mean, it was a terrorism case. It's been adjudicated and people are spending lives in prisons because of it. You know, I was on. So when you arrive in New York, the first thing you go is to an applicant squad. So you're put on A4, A6. You either do background investigations for people who want to do become an FBI agent, or you do federal background investigations. For example, I did part of Sotomayor's, the Supreme Court justice. So she, you know, has a big packet that's put together and sent to Congress for, and I have to go around and interview people because she, part of her life was in New York. So, you know, I had to build this packet of information to send to Congress for it. But when things go crazy like this, there was some intelligence that came in and there's a certain phrase, and I'm not going to repeat it here because it may be classified, but they look for this certain phrase, which meant a bombing. And so that's everybody. When there's a bomb threat with a known terrorist organization, everybody comes in and just, you know, works on it. So I was only in the office for a month and I'm already working on a case where we're doing surveillances around town. We're collecting information. We're interviewing people in the community. Because some guys said something in an email that made it sound like they wanted to blow up the subway. Come to find out they did. So thank God we were monitoring that account at that time.
Yeah, absolutely, Chris. That's amazing. So then when you're in training to become an FBI special agent, what does the training all entail? And what's that experience like?
So it's 21 weeks living on a Marine Corps base in the middle of Virginia, at Quantico, Virginia. They show shots of it on television shows and all that. It was built in 1972, and I don't think they've updated anything since 1972. So you have a roommate, and you and that roommate share a bathroom with two other guys. So the floor is your entire class. So there's rooms with girls, and there's room with boys. We're all on the same floor together because we do everything together. We eat together. We train together. It really builds that team mentality. But, I mean, you're doing everything from a PT test in the morning to shooting machine guns in the afternoon to learning terrorism by the end of the day. It's pretty intense, you know. And then there's a lot of crazy stories where they really put you through the test. Week 16 is the kind of the big test. And so there's your firearms training that you go to. And so through the first 16 weeks, I think you shoot about 3,500 rounds to get familiar with all the weapons that you're supposed to have familiarity with. And well, beyond familiarity, you're supposed to be intimate with your sidearm. And they give you three tests, and each of them score 50 points. And you have to pass at least two of the tests. If you fail the first one, everyone kind of looks around. And if you fail the second one, they immediately walk you off the line. And they take you up into your dorm, pack your stuff, and you're gone.
Really?
Right there. That's the pressure they put you under, that you've been with your class for 16 and a half weeks. And if you mess up on one round of your, or two rounds of your firearms, you leave. And then at the end of that 16 weeks, there's a thing called bull in the ring, where they put us all in groups of 10 in a circle with boxing gloves on. And you have to, one at a time, go into the middle, and each person beats you up for a minute. So for 10 straight minutes, you have to fight a group of 10 people. It's to show you that you have to stay in the fight. There's no giving up. If you give up, you're out. You're done. You have to stay in the fight all the way through. And, you know, it's hard. You've been living with these guys for, you know, for 16 weeks. And so and if you pull your punches, the instructors, you're out. So it's a life lesson that you can survive. No matter what's on top of you and what's pressuring you, you can build the mental fortitude to get through it.
So, Chris, what was it then that lured you out of the BU?
So I loved being an FBI agent. My whole plan was to be an FBI agent my whole entire life. You know, once I got in, that's what I thought. I was going to get the gold watch and retire. The last case I did was Silk Road. This was an online drug empire. It's $1.2 billion drug empire. Drugs were sold and everything was sold on there. There's only two things you couldn't sell on Silk Road. It was, you couldn't sell fake degrees and you couldn't sell guns. And the only reason the guns is that was just on a different site. But you could sell murders for hire. You could sell pure Afghan cocaine. You could sell heroin, whatever you wanted. Literally, you could sell children if you wanted to. But after I took down that case, so I became the very public face of it. It was a team effort, but I was the lead FBI agent, and the government had been shut down on October 1st. It was a stoppage of work due to funding. And I arrested Ross Ulbricht, the leader of Silk Road, on October 3rd. And so the only thing that went public was an affidavit I wrote for his arrest. So my name was what the media picked up on. Well, soon after that, the drug dealers that I took the $200 million from, there was about 5,000 drug dealers at the time on the site. They were pretty pissed. And so they put a hit out on me and my children. So it was a kind of a scary situation. So there was that, and, you know, it kind of led into a few other things at the time at the BU, as far as, you know, opportunities. Like, my next career path was to travel down to become a headquarters body and live in DC while my family lived in New York. So threats against my family, having to move me and to be away from my family, and then the little notoriety from the Silk Road case where I started getting job offers in the public. It all kind of lined up where probably it was my wife and I sat down and we prayed about it, and we, you know, came to the answer of that this is best for us.
Yeah. Yeah. Understood, Chris. Sounds like it was the right decision.
I miss it every day. I wish I was still part of the BU, but yeah, there's been a lot of things that I've been afforded and able to do. I just think of that. One of the things is, for the reason, I ended up in Iceland a lot of times on my cases. And you wonder why Iceland, because Iceland has free power, it has geothermal. So the heat comes up out of the ground and they turn that into electricity. And it also keeps servers very cold. Servers need cold temperature. They get very hot very quickly. So great place to put servers, Iceland, a lot of server farms over there. So. It is cheap. So a lot of bad guys know to use server farms in Iceland. So a lot of my cases would end up over there. So I'd fly over there. When you fly over there, you have a little bit of downtime. And there was a place over there called Thingvellir. I'm sure I'm messing that up, and people in Iceland are pissed about the way I pronounce it. But it's where the European continental plate and the U.S. continental plate are kind of pulling apart. And it's being filled in with lava and volcanoes. So that's where they're stretching away. And it's just beautiful. It's absolutely beautiful. And I stood there on one of my last trips there, and I was like, one day, if I could ever afford to bring my family here, that would be fantastic. And so when I left the bureau and, you know, made a little extra money being in private practice, that's the first thing we did is fly over to Iceland and took a family trip and got to see the entire island of Iceland. So beautiful place if anybody ever has the opportunity to go.
Yeah, fantastic. Yeah, it's been on my bucket list for some time. I'll get there eventually. Yeah, so you brought up Silk Road and you brought up Ross Ulbricht, and I think it's time we chat about it. So you already kind of went into it, but maybe I'll just ask it more generally and feel free to take it where you want. What was a Silk Road and who was Ross Ulbricht?
So Silk Road was an online dark market website. It operated on two different lines of anonymity. So one, it used Tor or the Onion Router, which is sort of the foundation of the dark web.
Right.
So let's go back a little further. There's dark web and deep web. Dark web is anywhere where illegal activity happens. If you can do something illegal on the internet, that's dark web. Deep web is the places Google can't touch. So it's un-Googleable. Like, for example, like, you wouldn't think this, but I'm sure many of your listeners have been on the deep web. They'll say, no, they haven't and all that. But can Google go into your bank account and find those details and pull it out? No, because it's protected by a username and password and hopefully two-factor authentication. Mm-hmm. That's in the deep web. That's places Google can't reach and can't index and go to. So again, the dark web is part of that deep web, but it's the part that's illegal. And there's some illegal in the normal internet too. But anyways, Silk Road ran on this. It's called an onion site. And so it was untraceable at the time. You couldn't figure out what was going on. And to this day, these onion sites remain untraceable. But there's some configuration issues sometimes that they give the law enforcement a clue on where to find them. But also, this was back in 2011 when people didn't know what a Bitcoin was. Silk Road operated on cryptocurrency. So the payments would go through. What would happen is you would go on the site. It was essentially like eBay, but again, protected by Tor, because so you couldn't find where the server was. And you would go on and somebody would be advertising drugs or whatever service, illegal service or something that way. And so a buyer would then send his cryptocurrency into an escrow account. And then the seller would send the good or service to an unknown address or something where they could be hidden. And once the transaction was finalized and everybody was happy, then the cryptocurrency would be then sent to the dealer or the seller. And so it really was, you know, the wild, wild west of eBay. I mean, it was back there, untraceable and illegal activity. And it was being run by a guy named Dread Pirate Roberts. So that's what he called himself, DPR. And so part of the case is once we found the server and gained the information from the server, our big step was to find the person. So the takedown of Silk Road was a three-pronged approach. And we wanted to arrest the guy running it. We wanted to put up a splash screen, you know, to show the world that this hidden service that no one could find was found and taken over by the federal government. We also wanted to seize all the cryptocurrency.
Excellent. As you mentioned earlier, the case got a vast amount of publicity. You as the lead investigator got more attention than most. And it was made into a movie, I think, just last year, wasn't it?
Yeah, so I wasn't really involved in that project. Okay. I have seen the project. It's not anywhere close to what the real story is. So I think it was one of those Hollywood movie magic type things that they took a lot of leeway with.
Sure, yeah. Where does the name come from, Silk Road?
Ross named it as part of from the Chinese route into Europe from, you know, running goods and, you know, from China all the way back to Europe. Once I think that was that Marco Polo that yeah. discovered the route. And so named after all, you know, being able to provide what some people don't have access to now access. Ross had a very libertarian point of view and was all about, you know, that people should make their own decisions and ingest whatever they want to ingest into their own bodies. And so, you know, Silk Road grew out of his efforts of actually growing mushrooms and wanting to put them on a website and make them available to anybody else. But the mushrooms then expanded out into, you know, again, anything is always as far bad as murders for hire. So,
yeah, extraordinary. Where's Ross now? Still in jail?
Ross was sentenced to 2 life sentences plus 40 years. So in the federal system, there is no chance of parole when you have that. I think he, from what I know, he's exhausted all of his options up through the Supreme Court. So the only way Ross gets out of jail now is presidential pardon.
Gotcha. Wow. You know, I'd love to know, Chris, and if you don't like the phrasing on this question, just let me know and I'll do my best. But if you were a cyber criminal, how would you evade the FBI?
So I don't think I could never do it. I'm too scared of jail. So I, you know, before I was an FBI agent, I was a local cop in Virginia, and like just going even there scared the crap out of me. So I would never do it.
Sure.
I don't think I really would like to make a roadmap on how criminals can evade the FBI. I've talked about it before. You can sort of, if you wanted to, you could certainly bury the FBI in evidence. So if you knew you were a cyber criminal and you knew the FBI was coming to your house, you know, buy a whole bunch of really big hard drives and just encrypt them. You don't even have to put anything on them, but they'll be spinning their wheels for a long time in order to get that information off there. But unfortunately, if you don't encrypt and don't hide your real activity, like if, let's say you're selling drugs on Silk Road and you have no control over the server, there's no way. I mean, they don't need to open those hard drives to arrest you and put you in jail for that. So, you know, that's the one kind of way just to kind of piss them off. And so I wouldn't prescribe that either. I think the best way to avoid being arrested for cybercrime is to not commit cybercrime.
Yep. Well, I've been living the clean life. No, never tried. I tried to give a nice, clever response. I didn't get there. Oh, I'll just leave it there. Thank you, Chris.
You're better off. You're better off not getting involved in cybercrime in any sort of way, because, you know, cyber cops are getting a lot better. So You know, it used to just be the low-hanging fruit. Now a lot of people are getting caught up because you'd be surprised where you leave evidence when you do things.
Right. Absolutely. So then, Chris, I'd love to know, throw a couple words at you. What is Lulzsec, Cebu, and Anonymous? And, you know, feel free to start that story in whatever way makes the most sense for you.
Sure. So Anonymous is a decentralized collection of people that kind of hang out in the same place. They say they're leaderless. And this started way back in the day. This started on like 4chan, 8chan, that type of thing, back in the late 90s, early 2000s. And it kind of grew from there. Anonymous doesn't go back that far, but the origins of this sort of thing goes back that far. Around 2009, 2010, Anonymous came through. You saw them like Operation Occupy Wall Street, where you saw the kind of the physical world and all that. They, you know, had a thing against when WikiLeaks came out. They were very against when MasterCard and Visa said that they couldn't take donations that were going through WikiLeaks. And so they kind of grew in power there. I say they're a decentralized, headless organization. That's not really true. What brings you power in Anonymous is if you have, you know, hacking abilities, hacking tools, or like the control of a botnet that they can use. So around that same time in 2010, there was a guy named Aaron Barr, who was running a cybersecurity company named HB Gary Federal. He came out and said he was going to decloak or de-anonymize Anonymous. And that's really where Anonymous is. Their power came from is no one knew who they were. You know, you could be an Anonymous and we wouldn't know. You know, anybody could be there because, you know, physical person versus persona online just wasn't matched up. But Aaron Barr said he was going to de-anonymize Anonymous. He had come up with a technique where he was matching like people online with times tweets were coming out and things like that. It was not really sciencey behind it, but he said he was going to do it. So what happened is a group of Anonymous members got together and they decided they were going to go on the attack and see what Aaron Barr knew. And so they hacked into HB Gary Federal. Unfortunately, Aaron didn't do so well with cybersecurity, even though he ran a federal cybersecurity company. He kept in his email a list of his passwords, an unsent, a draft email that controlled the passwords to everything. And so these guys got in there, took over his life, and HB Gary Federal stopped being a company soon after that. But these six guys worked very, very well together. And so they became Lulzsec, or laughing at your security, was sort of their motto. And they went on a 50 days of terror, just completely hacking into anything they could get their hands on and kind of embarrassing the FBI along the way for that. But their leader, at least externally from what we saw, was a guy named Sabu, who I refer to as the Kaiser Sose of hacking of the time. Everyone was looking for this guy, you know, and this is the guy we wanted who was in the news all the time. And so that becomes the FBI's big target that summer.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. And if my research was correct, Chris, you were able to make Sabu an informant, correct?
So yeah, through some investigation and a source we found, we were able to put the person on the Lower East Side, a guy named Hector Monsecor, with Sabu. So my squad raced up there late at night on a June night and knocked on this guy's door. We sat at his table for a few hours and finally he said that, you know, I am Sabu. And so that was sort of the linchpin in the case. And so normally, you know, we'd have the leader of, you know, a big group like this and we take him downtown and, you know, look how great we are. We arrested this guy and all that. We decided that we were going to use Sabu. Sabu didn't really know anybody. I mean, Anonymous didn't know anybody else. Like even the leader of the hacking crew of Anonymous didn't know the other people. There was no need to know the real person. So really what we wanted Sabu for was to learn about really what was happening in the hacking world. So for the next 9 months, he and I sat next to each other every single day, 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, just learning, drinking from a fire hose on what hacking was really going on.
Wow. I'd love to know, Chris, how is it that you got him to trust you? What's the process like in, so to speak, converting someone to becoming an informant?
Everyone has their own ways. That's one of the classes we take in the FBI Academy. They teach you tricks on how to get someone, but really just come from experience. And you kind of have to read the person, what they're looking for, and kind of give it to them. I mean, it's not much different than, you know, dating. When you're trying to court a partner, you kind of change your personality a little bit to fit exactly what they're looking for and then to get to know them. And you ask certain types of questions. But, you know, what really came down with Hector was respect. To treat him like a human being, treat him not like just an arrestee or some criminal or something like that. Treat him with respect. And that really was how we responded. And, you know, the leader of this big hacking group now became, you know, an FBI informant.
Wow. That's amazing. Thank you, Chris. Let me see. Well, who is, I hope I'm saying it right, who is AV Unit?
So AV Unit was one of the members of LulzSec. There was Sabu, Kayla, Topiary, T-Flow, and AV Unit. Oh, and Pwn Sauce. And so I was able to identify through the investigation between us, and I had a great partner over in the UK, the guy that worked for the Met named Matt Stanley. He was the case agent over there. We were able to identify all the members of LulzSec except for this one guy, AV Unit. He sort of stepped away right before Hector and I became colleagues and working together on the case. Now, whether he was tipped off, I don't think so. Hector didn't have a relationship with him. He was the infrastructure guy. So if you needed a server somewhere or a hot point, AV Unit was the guy to set that up. And he's still out there. He's still, you know, doing his thing. And I think he's in on Twitter. So I mentioned him on Lex Fridman, and it sort of, you know, some fame came back to him on that one. So, you know, he's the guy that I wasn't able to ever catch.
Yeah. Is he your white whale, so to speak?
Yeah, I guess sort of. I mean, it would have been nice to get all six members. But I mean, we did a lot of good work with LulzSec. We stopped over 300 hacks into just the U.S. government alone. Over 1,000 other victims we were able to identify with vulnerabilities these hackers were getting into. But yeah, it would have been nice to get all six of them.
Definitely. Chris, there's a question I'd love to ask you. You actually did have a similar discussion with Lex Fridman last month, and I wanted to ask you as well. So is it possible for me to have a podcast conversation with someone that hasn't been caught yet?
Hasn't been caught yet? You're going to have to build up a lot of trust with that person. There's a lot of technical things like what we're doing right here. I could probably get your IP address pretty easy. We're on a peer-to-peer conversation. If I knew you were scheduling this, I definitely could subpoena Zoom and get the connection logs, you know, and then so if someone was monitoring, like, say this law enforcement or something, you know, that person's going to have to go through a bunch of different steps to protect their identity. You know, if I knew ahead of time that I could get a wire up, and if they're going through a hot point or a VPN, I could go very quickly and try to get those records and kind of find out who it is. So, and then, you know, cyber criminals are very opportunistic, but a large part of their skill set is social engineering. I mean, that means, you know, tricking to you, lying to you, trying to get you to do things that they want you to do or think a certain way. So I think you could have a conversation, but it would be difficult to know if that's the real person you're talking to.
Sure.
You know, whether they're putting it on a persona or physically, they're a different person. And the real person's off screen. And this person is just trying to, you know, pretend to be them. You know, it would be difficult to, one, assure their safety, and two, that they're really being open and honest with you with your answers. So it'd be, you know, it could be a make-believe conversation.
Right. Yeah, that makes sense to me. I'd like to know, Chris, if you think there's a particularly big threat today that's especially pervasive.
There's tons of them. There's lots of them. And I really hate going around and scaring the pants off people, you know, about how weak our cybersecurity or defensive are. In fact, on our podcast, Hacker and the Fed, we come out this week on an episode that's coming out on Thursday and talking about how, you know, maybe it's not as bad as we thought it was based on some of the Russian hackers. They're not as powerful as we thought, because we're going to see that. Excuse me, from the Ukrainian war, that the hackers aren't as elite as we expected. But there's a lot of low-hanging fruit. There's a lot of people that click on links. There's a, you know, clicking on a link in your email. How many times do we have to tell you not to click on links? There's a lot of people that give information over the phone when people call. You know, there was $1.7 billion taken from the United States last year in elderly fraud. That's just people calling older people and social engineering, convincing them to be scared and to give the information up over their phone. One thing we do at Naxo is a thing called crypto recovery. So when people are defrauded or lose their crypto or get lost, lose the keys to their crypto, we help them with it. And we are seeing an uptick in the number of people reaching out to us to help them recover their crypto because, you know, we had a guy, a client who, you know, gave complete control of his computer to a guy who said he was an exchange. No one's going to ask for complete control of your PC. They're not going to be able to, they shouldn't be able to click on things and go through things. Don't give them access like that, you know? So yeah, I mean, if we could remove users from computers, then cybersecurity would be great. But unfortunately, you know, that user interaction is what's needed. And too many people they worry about questioning why someone is asking them to do something. You should question that. You should always question why someone's asking you to do that. Your bank is never going to call you and ask for your password. Never. If they do, you should change banks that day. So, I mean, I wish it was a sexier answer for you of what this next big threat is, you know. I mean, there's threats on the other end about, you know, using AI to attack us. You know, if you train AI to be a hacker, it's going to eventually learn your password. It's going to learn your times of day and you know, all that. I mean, it can be used against you very easily, you know. So on the technical side, there's much scarier things. One thing I've been telling people for a while now, I think we're going to see the end of usernames and passwords here soon. Things are going towards a thing called FIDO, which is an encryption token that allows you to interact with a sign-on computer. Like, so if you want to log into Google or log into Apple, your little token that you've pre-described sets up an encrypted pathway. So that should help. I mean, kind of where we are with cybercrime. It's, you know, low-hanging fruit and whack-a-mole. But there's stuff out there that will help protect us a lot more coming, as long as people are a little bit more private with their stuff and think through things before they click on the links.
Right. Interesting. That makes sense. Well, I was wrong then. I thought you were going to say insider threats.
Oh, yeah. That's sort of outdated. You know, we're kind of going to zero trust. A lot of stuff internally on like these business networks are zero trust. And that doesn't, so that's a direct reaction to ransomware. So ransomware is so prevalent. So let's go through a little history of ransomware real quick, just so people know. So we've had encryption for 50 years. That's great. You know, nothing's really happened with it. Why did ransomware blow up in the last 10 years? Cryptocurrency. We haven't had a way to pay criminals. You know, you could send a big duffel bag of cash, but guess what? Where are you going to send it? You know, it's like ransom. We're going to follow that duffel bag of cash. Cryptocurrency has allowed us to exploit ransomware. You know, ransom, you know, that's how we pay bad guys. But why is ransomware so good? Because we've built these networks that allows the malware to go from one user to the next user and just transverse our network. We, you know, once you're inside the network, once you're inside that fence around your network, you know, a program can go anywhere. So now the reaction to that is zero trust, meaning that when we're on a company network, your computer doesn't need access to everything. It only needs access to the things it needs at that specific time, and then it loses that access. There's no reason for it to continue to have access, like the file server. If you don't, you know, pull down the file and that's it, you're done. You know, you don't need access. You don't need constant open, you know, you have to re-authenticate to it again. So zero trust and the insider threat sort of going away in businesses as we move towards that because it's a reaction to ransomware. Now, I will say for one of the biggest problems with insider threats is your home networks. You know, we've prescribed for years compartmentalization for networks, meaning, you know, this thing where if your ship gets pierced, the whole ship doesn't sink because you have it in different compartments. But I bet most people on their home networks have one router, one network, and it's spread across. And those same Wi-Fis that they do all their banking on, their kids are doing whatever they're doing on their computers, including, you know, Minecraft and the executables and that sort of thing.
Right.
So, you know, think about putting things off, putting, you know, from technical terms, your VLANs or even just more physical routers, you know, set your networks up so your kids are on their own router, you know, which is helpful. Things to think about, simple things like that. You know, we need to apply more business practices to our home networks because we have a lot more things on our networks, you know, Internet of Things, you know, thermostats, you know, cameras inside our houses, you know, all these things that you're able to log into from outside puts a hole in your defenses. There's a hole. If you're at the mall and you can log into a camera in your house, that means there's a hole in your security defenses. Now it's fine because you know about it. You put it there, but you have to be aware that that's punching holes in the fence.
Yeah. Something for listeners to think about. I know we talked a little bit about Naxo, but I'd love to discuss it a little further with you, Chris. When did you start it?
We started in June. We've only been a company for about 6 months.
Wow.
So yeah, so it's four guys right now and we are growing. We are looking for people. We have applications coming in every single day. Lex Friedman did a great job of opening the applicant pool for us. We get emails almost every single day for people that want to join. But it's former government guys that come together. So again, we all have our skill set. You know, I have some notoriety and the investigative skills. My friend Matt Edmond is the smartest guy I've ever met. He invents great things. Dave is a great business guy. And Tom Kiernan, he's been, you know, in the FBI. He was in the FBI. He was the first computer scientist in New York for the FBI. So he's seen a lot of things and a lot of experience. So We've been in consultancies before, but there were some roadblocks in that. We like to invent things. We like to help people invent, you know, if they have a big problem, to invent new things. And consultancies don't really, you know, they want billable hours and they want, you know, to talk to the money coming in all the time. We want to start a company where, yeah, we're making money. We're a company and that's what you're supposed to do as a company, make money. But we also want to invent things that would solve problems for people. And so people come to us with some of their harder problems that technologically they can't solve. And we like to sit around and think about it. It's fun for us. It exercises our brains.
Excellent. And how can people find out about it, Chris?
Website, naxo.com. We're all on there. And so there's a lot of great things. Thanks for that opportunity to plug the business.
Yeah, you're welcome, man. You're welcome. I did have one slightly self-indulgent question, Chris. I hope you forgive it. But, you know, I got to tell you, Lex Fridman is one of my favorite podcasts. He's great. And I'd love to know, and I'll bet one or two of our listeners would as well, what is the experience of going on the Lex Fridman podcast like? How do they reach out to you? What's that experience like?
It's surreal because I've been a Lex podcast guy for a long time. So when I got his email, I was blown away. When he's like, oh, here's my cell phone number, blown away. And then I show up and I knock on his door and Lex answers the door. That was crazy. And it's weird, though. You're sitting there, you're kind of in the studio and you're looking around. And you're like, you know, I've seen this studio. I was on episode 340, so I must have seen it 339 times before, or at least the ones he does in the studio. And then he comes, you know, we're talking. He's still talking. He's yelling from upstairs and he comes down in that black suit. I'm like, oh, my God. It's Lex, you know, he changes into the podcast host and he starts off with that close picture of your face that's done before the interview. I mean, so you're like, oh man, I'm sure I've got some sort of pimple on my face or something like that. And so all your insecurities come boiling. But then he just sits down and literally you feel like you're not even on a microphone. You're just talking to a guy and, you know, he's engaged. He's well researched. You know, and I really admire the broad range of topics that he has, you know, anything, you know, from jujitsu to programming to my dumb stories, you know, it's great. I love the experience. If Lex Fridman ever reaches out to you and says, hey, you want to be on the podcast, you better say yes.
Oh, believe me, I'll be there. I'll be there with bells on. No, thanks, Chris. I appreciate that, man. So I'd love to know, what's a question about being an FBI special agent that nobody's asked you that you wish someone would ask?
Well, you always get the stuff about, you know, firing your gun and all the gun questions. People love that. A question about an FBI agent. So I have a podcast now called Hacker in the Fed. And one of the things is the questions that come in, and some of them are interesting and all that. But my co-host on the Hacker in the Fed is actually Hector Montsecor, Sabu, the guy I arrested. So I arrested my co-host and one of my close friends now. He was facing 125 years in prison and then worked his way out of that by sitting with me and working our way. And so Hacker in the Fed is about two perspectives of, you know, from a federal agent and a former hacker on different cybersecurity issues. We have guests on once in a while, that sort of thing. And so I find the most interesting, the questions he asked me. He says that, you know, the FBI is so, you know, such a mystery to the hacking world. And it's weird because he spent 9 months with me and he would think it would be, you know completely what's going on and all that. He always said it was most surprising to him how playful and how much like fun we had together as a group. He thought, you know, FBI agents were just in suits, very, you know, just robotic almost, and was quite surprised about the, you know, that we were normal people and that we had a good time with each other. And so I like to make sure people know that, you know, yeah, the FBI is very professional on the outside, you know, but when we have time to ourselves and can get together as a group, man, we play hard. It's a good time and fun. So it's a great job. If anybody's thinking about being an FBI agent, you know, there's some bad publicity going on out there about the FBI right now. But, you know, I love the FBI. Some of the experiences that they're talking about in the news media, I did not find them to be the same when I was in the Bureau. I've got a lot of close friends that are still there. If it's something you're interested in and always wanted to be an FBI agent, I would highly recommend keep going down that path because it's a great job.
Excellent. Chris Tarbell, how can we find out about you, my friend?
Again, naxo.com, Hacker in the Fed, new episode every Thursday. Hector and I break down cybersecurity. If you have a question about FBI agents or about hackers or anything about your own personal cybersecurity, reach out to us. We have an email, questions@hackerinthefed.com. So just out there telling the world about how to secure themselves a little bit better.
Absolutely. Chris, thank you so much for taking the time for me today. I really appreciate it. This was a lot of fun.
Thanks. No, I had a great time. This was exciting and a lot of great questions. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, man. Well, hope you have a great rest of the day and you take care.
Thanks. Have a good one.
Bye, cheers. Chris. Bye.
Thanks for listening to this episode. For more information on Eyewitness History, along with show notes and links to resources, go to ParthenonPodcast.com, where you can also listen to some other great podcasts by the Parthenon Network, such as Scott Rank's History Unplugged, Steve Guerra's Beyond the Big Screen, and James Early's Key Battles of American History, along with many others. Thank you.
The Historical Jesus Podcast is the sweeping saga of the life and times of Galilean Jesus of Nazareth, as well as the faith, religion, and church founded to honor and disseminate his acts and teachings. Join me, Mark Vinette, on this fascinating journey through time, exploring the many great works of Christian theology, literature, architecture, music, and art, inspired by the words and deeds of Jesus Christ.